Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you Disclosure Network with Nick Curto. Greetings and welcome, Nick. How are you tonight?
Great, never better. I'm a survivor of the day. The first weekend with all the Christmas shopping going on, it was like the gold rush in the old West. Oh, my God.
I'm looking forward to tonight's show, as I do all of your shows, but especially on tonight's show.
Well, thank you. Me too. It's going to be a good one. Promise you that. And so for our listeners out there, thank you for tuning in. The program is the Disclosure Network with Nick Curto, and I'm Nick Curto, your co-founder and director of Disclosure Network New York. And DNNY is a grassroots organization not celebrating, I can't believe this, 25 years of providing two meetings per month throughout the year in Manhattan. We focus on cutting-edge UFO ET issues, paranormal phenomenon of all kinds, as well as many important and related subjects from a wide variety of sources as we go very deep into these exciting and sometimes quite misunderstood subjects that the mainstream media will never talk about or disclose on any level. Our members, which I cannot tell you, they're the best, do intensive investigative research into these various areas, cutting edge hot topics, and share their information that they found themselves with our group at our DNNY meetings in Manhattan and also on our internet service we have. We are currently doing a Zoom meeting on the third Thursday of each month from 7:30 to 9 p.m. throughout 2023 and 2024 for our members. And that schedule will continue on. We're not going to differentiate from that. We've had a lot of great discussions that's opened. Usually we do a meeting with just the people that want to talk about what they've discovered, but occasionally we'll also do a guest speaker for that Zoom meeting. We also produce a face-to-face meeting in the West Village of New York City at a place called The Center, located at 208 West 13th Street, and that's scheduled for the first Sunday of each month throughout 23 and 24. That meeting goes from 2:30 to 4 o'clock, and believe me, it's the quickest and most amazing 90 minutes you will ever spend. We have amazing guest speakers and a Q&A after they talk. We then also go to a coffee hour at a nearby coffee shop at 4 p.m. directly after our meeting. We have a guest fee of a low $15 if we have seats available. And tomorrow, which is the first Sunday of December, we will be meeting, of course, at 2:30 p.m. at the center. If you want to know more about that, you can email me, and I'll give you more information about that. Now, tomorrow's talk is going to be none other than Mark Breckerhoff and his wife, Phyllis, certainly two of the most aware, knowledgeable, and enlightened folks that you will ever know. Well, Mark is a walk-in and has deep, deep knowledge. And he's an amazing person, truly, one of my favorite people to interview. And we will have a Q&A for that time remaining of that meeting. It will be a packed meeting, so if you want more information, I can give you that. To do that, I'm going to give you my personal email address, and you can do your inquiries for either the membership or that particular meeting tomorrow. Just let me know. My email address, if you have a pencil and paper handy. I'm going to go slowly, and I will repeat it. NICKNYNY1, that's the numeral 1, at gmail.com. I'm going to repeat it. NICKNYNY1 at gmail.com. Now, our website is www.dnny.info. I'm going to repeat that, dnny.info. Okay, with that said, let's get right to it. My featured guest for this evening December 2nd, 2023. A very warm welcome indeed to my friend and colleague, the multi-talented Tim Schwartz. Tim, great to have you with us.
Why, thank you, Nick and Hercules. I appreciate you having me on tonight, and it's a pleasure to talk with both of you.
I want to tell our listeners out there tonight about Tim Schwartz, just a little tiny bit about him. He's an award-winning, Emmy Award-winning television producer, videographer, photojournalist, and author of a number of amazing popular books. We'll get into that. Tim has been a writer and editor of an online newsletter called The Conspiracy Journal, a free weekly email newsletter considered essential reading by paranormal researchers worldwide. Now, Tim worked on the webcast Exploring the Bizarre with the extraordinarily talented and loved Timothy Green Buckley, who recently passed on a few years ago. Tim also worked on KCOR Digital Radio Network and so much more. We cover a number of details of these positions in our program tonight as we have time for it. Tim, I got to say, with such a huge undertaking and diverse interests of all kinds, do you ever sleep?
Well, you know, just before we came on, I mean, we were discussing setting up times to do shows. And I'm like, oh, well, I can't do this day because I have this show to do. Oh, I can't do this day because I got another show to do. And then somewhere in between, all of this, I'm currently writing a new book, always in the process of writing a book. And then, of course, I have a family to take care of as well. So that's a good question, Nick. I'm not sure. Sometimes I close my eyes, but that's about it.
Yeah, I'm really not surprised at all with that comment. I'm not. Oh my God, your list goes on and on. I really admire all that you do, and I wanted to start off just briefly with a little bit of background because people don't really know your background, including me. And so, just a few key questions, if I may.
Sure.
First of all, starting at the beginning, where were you born? And where do you make your home now?
Well, I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, and grew up in a town called Elwood, Indiana, which was about 50 miles north of Indianapolis. And then after I went to college and started working for various television stations and video production companies, I moved around quite a bit for a while. Then I ended up back in Indianapolis again, working for the state PBS station. It was WFYI Channel 20. And through that, they had a for-profit arm of video production. So on top of doing a lot of the programming for the PBS station, then we did a lot of work for all kinds of different entities, ESPN and various networks that would come into town to cover something. At the time, Channel 20 had the only satellite uplink in Indianapolis. So if there was anything going on and there was somebody in town that the other networks wanted to talk to, they would come to Channel 20 to do the interviews and be uplinked. Through that, I got to travel around quite a bit and meet a lot of interesting people and really just see and experience a lot of fantastic things. And between all of that, Nick, I managed to research, investigate, and write about the world of the weird, the strange phenomena, UFOs, ghosts, cryptid creatures, and all of that. So, I mean, I've been that kind of busy for many, many years now.
Well, certainly understood. Absolutely. Good for you. Really good for you. I want to go back just for a second. Did you come from a large family with brothers and sisters?
No, just a small family. It was just myself, and then I had a younger sister. Still do. She's she lives in St. Louis now, but no, I mean just a kind of your standard middle class nuclear family. Even had a dog and several cats.
I hear that. What was your mom and dad like? Just briefly, but I just like to curious about that.
Well, they never tried to dissuade me from my interests. But you have to realize, Nick, that it wasn't until I was around in third grade that I became interested in this kind of stuff. And that really was only secondhand because I had been given a classroom assignment to do a story about UFOs. There was a UFO flap going on in the United States at that time. All the kids in the class got like a newspaper headline that they had to do a story on. I got one about UFOs. I didn't know anything about UFOs, but I did the story anyway. And after that, that was it. I was pegged like the flying saucer guy. I was the person who believed in little green men from Mars and all of that stuff. It was because of that that got me interested, because, you know, people would then come to you by themselves afterwards to tell you their stories. And that's what was really fascinating to me. Sure, the stories are interesting, but the people coming to tell me these stories who had no idea that other people were having similar experiences. And that's really what set me off down the path that I'm on today.
Right, right. That's understandable. Interesting that that's the way it broke for you. And also, were you a fan of sci-fi movies also at that time, and did that continue?
Yes. Yes, I was. I liked science fiction. I liked horror movies. I was interested in science, especially like rocket science. You know, at the time, the Gemini and Apollo missions were just getting started and were actually, you know, being televised. So I was very interested in that. But when I was a kid, my real love was race cars, like Indy 500 race cars, naturally living close to Indianapolis. So, I mean, I was all about the Indianapolis 500. So, I mean, if the teacher had given me an assignment about the Indy 500, we may not be having this conversation.
Yeah, well, there's not going to be enough time to do all the questions that I have for you, because I really am very interested in that. And I wanted to just briefly mention, and we want to go into this in more detail, but I just wanted to put this out there right now. From your many subjects that you've devoted some decent writing time for, the Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla, America's Strange and Supernatural History, Time Travel, A Fact or Fiction, Men of Mystery, Nikola Tesla and Otis T. Carr. I want to know about that. The Admiral Byrd's Secret Journey Beyond the Poles. That, I got to talk to you about that. And also Geff, G-E-F, The Talking Mongoose, The Eighth Wonder of the World. Come on, baby, talk to me about these, oh my God, these amazing interests and these books.
Well, you know, I will have to say that it all got started because of the late, great Timothy Green Beckley. You know, I became associated with him back in 1983 after I did an interview with J. Allen Hynek and put it up on the CBS television news feed, which made it possible for any CBS station across the country to run that story. So Beckley must have seen it, wanted me to send him a VHS copy, which I did. So then years later, he was starting to produce a magazine called UFO Universe. and asked me if I was interested in writing some articles for it. And that's how it started. And he had a small publishing company, and he had an in-house writer who went by under the pseudonym of Commander X that he had under contract for a couple of books that Commander X wasn't going to be able to fulfill due to health problems. So he asked me if I could take the notes and material that Commander X had put together at that point and finish up the books for him. And that's how it started for me. So then after a couple of these books were that were supposed to be from Commander X, I did The Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla, which came out, I think, around 1999. And it hasn't been out of print since. But, you know, Nikola Tesla was a fascinating guy. And, I mean, we could spend the entire show just talking about him. But that book was really the one that took off and helped keep me writing.
I can imagine that would be true, absolutely. And, you know, I just read something, funny enough, we're bringing this up, that Tesla was photographed in a car, and it wasn't propelled by gasoline, and it wasn't propelled by water, which another inventor invented. And Tesla said, it's running on the energies of the earth. Have you ever known anything about that?
Yeah, that's a story that this had happened after his famous wireless transmitter at on Long Island debacle, where his investors pulled out because they couldn't figure out how Tesla was going to charge customers for wireless electricity. So Tesla kept up his interest in powering things using electricity, and he was working on a Pierce Arrow car that he was able to, in his experiments, run around the state of New York countryside without any apparent means of propulsion. I mean, he didn't have a gas engine. It wasn't steam. It was electricity of some kind. Now, electric cars were around at that time, but the batteries were huge honking things, and didn't last very long. And Tesla's car, I guess, ran all day long without being charged. But nobody really knows just exactly how he was doing it. There was speculation that he had actually, in the place that he was staying, set up like a little electrical transmitter based on his Wardenclyffe Tower and was broadcasting electricity to this car. And then others say that that he may have developed a new type of battery that was smaller and was able to last longer based on the current science. We don't know. You know, it could have been a combination of all of the above or none of the above. Unfortunately, due to the problems that Tesla had with patent infringements, he kept his ideas around that time very close to the vest and would not reveal how he was doing things for fear, naturally enough, that they were going to be stolen.
Now let's go down the rabbit hole, if you will, with the invention. And it could have been battery, or it could have been something else that was transmitted that powered Tesla's car. And the other gentleman, which I do not remember his name at this moment, who powered his car by water and was alleged to have gone around 60 miles an hour, so it was quite heavy powered to do that. And needless to say, that gentleman with the water-powered car was murdered, and the car disappeared, and nobody knew anything from that point on. And, of course, Tesla's car, which seems to me at the time was revolutionary, and both of these gentlemen somehow disappeared from that particular kind of invention. And you wonder, well, what could have done that? Well, talk about gas and oil and coal and the multi-billion trillion dollar market, and this would not be something that they would want. Do you think that might be true?
Oh, well, you know, there's been several people that have come out with water-powered cars that seem to have met with unlikely ends. You know, some of them have been bought out, naturally, and then others, I guess, who refused to sell out, ended up dying under mysterious circumstances. With Tesla, you know, he was the type of inventor that he would work on something for quite a long time, and then he would get an idea for something else, and that would become the flavor of the month. And so his earlier works would kind of get, you know, tossed aside for a while. That could have been very well, you know, what had happened to Tesla, because, I mean, around the time that he was working on the Pierce Arrow, that would have been probably in the, I think, early 1920s. Don't quote me on that, Nick. But then, you know, I mean, he lived for another at least 23 years after that. But and I'm sure that if an investor had approached him with the right amount of money, he would have been more than happy to have worked with him, because to Tesla, money was a means of continuing his scientific work. He enjoyed a good meal, a glass of whiskey, you know, a nice place to stay, but he wasn't into the whole obnoxious wealth type of situations. But apparently nobody was really interested at that time in what Tesla was working on. So, you know, he had gone on to something else by that point.
You know, that is amazing. And I can see how that would be so true on the levels you just mentioned. But think of it, this could have been a turning point in automotive history. And the vehicles we have now would be very, very different. Just if you project that a little bit, I mean, that's quite something. I want to go back just for a moment with Timothy Green of Beckley, because I want to bring in my producer, Hercules. Hercules, you have a story, I believe, about Timothy Beckley. Could you just talk a little bit about that? I think that Tim would be interested.
Which story?
you had a relationship with him.
I didn't really know Tim Beckley very well. I believe we first crossed paths at the Fortean Society meetings that John Keel used to run. And later on, I contacted him when I was in Pennsylvania and I had another podcast. And he had just made some movies. I believe it was one on vampires, and you know, they were like supernatural, sexy films, I guess you can call them. And I reviewed them.
Yes, I worked on those movies.
Yeah, they were fun, and I remember putting my reviews up, and I believe I posted some of the reviews on Amazon or some other visible site. And then I was telling Tim a little bit about my work, and he sent over a box of books and videos, and slowly I reviewed them all and interviewed some of the people on the podcast at the time. Then, you know, basically if you publish something that I saw that I liked, that I thought would fit into the theme of the shows, I'd give him a call, ask for a review copy, and, you know, pretty much we did that. So I didn't really know Tim very well. Tim was one of my heroes when I was growing up. I believe at the time he was publishing like out of print, public domain type of occult books. And I was very much into occultism from an early age. So it was great to be able to find those books affordably. And they were in, I believe, spiral notebook type of things. So I remember as a child, my parents asked me to come to some relatives and I didn't want to go. But then they said it was in New Brunswick, and I knew that's where Tim Beckley was. So I said, okay, stayed for a little while at my relative's house, and then I went out of Tim Beckley, And I wandered around looking for his house or any indication of where he might be. I asked some people if they knew, and nobody knew. And later on, I was told by Dory that I was actually like a block away from their house at the time, when where Tim used to run his business from there. So I guess, in short, that's my experiences with Tim. He was progressive in very many ways. He came up with the best titles for things. And they were always very catchy titles that drew your attention. And I made it my life goal to become an investigator like Tim Beckley and the people who contributed toward his paranormal anthologies, all of which had lurid titles. So that became one of my aspirations. And I was very proud when I think it's Sean Castile wrote, you know, praising my written work and including me in that bunch of people. And I knew some of the other authors like Brad Steiger. Brad had been on several of my podcasts, and we've had some really good conversations. Now I'm overjoyed to be talking to Tim Schwartz, who was one of my heroes as well during this process. And I'm very proud to be included in their number. So I guess those are my Tim Beckley stories.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I love connecting the dots, as you know. And yeah. I love hearing the backstories, because I'm not aware of a lot of these backstories. And to me, it really helps me to understand the whole background and the networking that's been going on.
And
so let's go on the level. Tim, do you have anything else? I want to go to another one of your books, but is there anything else you want to say at the moment?
Oh no! It's just I just want to say that we're continuing that relationship with Hercules, and recent books that I've published under our Zontar Press heading have also included Hercules. So it's been a great pleasure these years working with Hercules, with Tim Beckley's books, and now we're continuing this relationship with Zontar Press.
And I'm
excellent,
greatly honored,
excellent.
And you will have something in your email in the next couple of days.
Thank you, Hercules.
There you go.
Very well.
There you go. Well, all right. Another book that I just wanted to ask you about, because certainly has my interest, time travel has always been very, very special to me, that whole subject of going either forward or backward. And you did some research on this, and I just would love to have you give us some of the thoughts you have when doing your book and what you found out, maybe what you were surprised about or what questions you still might have about time travel.
Well, the book that you listed is called Time Travel Fact Not Fiction, and this was actually a newer incarnation of one of the original ones that Commander X was in the process of writing and had to stop, and then I finished it up. And when I got a hold of it, it was really just some notes, maybe a couple of strange stories, and that was about it. Commander X was seemed to be centering more along the occult angle of time travel, listing old spells that people could do that would somehow, you know, elicit travel through time. Stories about, who was it? King Solomon, I think is who it was, or somebody like that, who had a ring that would enable him to go back in time in, like, what was it? It was some like 7-minute increment, something like that, some supposedly holy number. I took the book and then continued on later with Time Travel Not Fact Not Fiction, with bringing out the stories about time slips. And that's what really got my attention on the whole subject was, you know, people are always talking about like time machines, you know, who's going to invent a time machine, you know, be like Back to the Future and pull the lever and go to the 1,000 years into the future. But it seems like maybe Mother Nature already has a method, and she keeps showing us every now and then with what are called time slips, which is a phenomena where somebody will find themselves seemingly in the past, sometimes the future, where they'll have, I mean, just an experience like they are actually there. I mean, they'll be able to breathe the air, and they'll see like the concrete sidewalk change from that to bricks. The cars will disappear to be replaced by, say, horse-drawn carriages. Sometimes they can interact with the people, sometimes not. And then just as inexplicably find themselves back in the present day. And, you know, I found that just absolutely fascinating. And, you know, as time has gone by, I've collected more and more of these types of stories. And it's just, you know, it has me wondering just what exactly is going on in the universe and what is reality if time can be, I don't know, manipulated, viewed, looped, whatever you want to call it, that easily. Is it because somebody is at the right place at the right time to experience it? Are some places more susceptible to time slips? Or is it just, you know, just a random event? You know, I don't know. I mean, all these years of studying this, I still haven't got any clear idea. Some people, you know, they're very fixated on the, well, you know, it's one location. You know, one location always has, you know, that. And it's like, I think that there's other factors involved. But yeah, I mean, it's I think that if physicists start taking a more serious look at these types of events, they may start getting a grasp on, who knows, a whole new branch of physics that hasn't been discovered yet. And, you know, Mother Nature is like shoving it right under our noses. Here, take a look at this. So far, we've just been ignoring them.
Absolutely true. There's some stories been kicking around that I've been following. One of them has to do with the whole places, the Vatican. And there's been several reports, and they go way back, that the Vatican has in their possession, secretly way deep down, deep in their vaults, a time machine. They were able to view things thousands of years ago, including the crucifixion of Jesus. Now, who knows if that's true, but it's some fascinating reading. Have you heard anything about that, that the Vatican's there's a name for that machine. And have you ever come across any material about that?
Yes, and the machine was called the Coronavisor. And this was supposedly invented by he wasn't a Vatican priest. I think that he was actually stationed in, oh my gosh, maybe Vienna, not Vienna, Venice. And he was actually an expert on Gregorian chants and ancient languages. But because of an experience that he had where he heard somebody was recording bird calls in a forest, and this person's supposedly deceased father's voice came across this tape. I'm trying to remember now what the priest's name is, but I can't think of it just off the top of my head, Nick. Sorry. So he, because of his interests, apparently the Vatican helped get together a number of physicists and scientists. Supposedly one of these scientists was Wernher von Braun, and I'm not quite sure why Wernher von Braun would be involved, because he was a rocket scientist, but that's the name that comes up, you know, in these stories. And they were able to put together a device that the theory was is that everything that happens to us, that energy never goes away. You know, I mean, that's, you know, E equals MC squared, that sort of thing. And that light, that sound, that energy has to be somewhere. And it could be feasible that with the right kind of antennas, dialing in the right kind of frequencies, you could tune that in like a radio receiver, like you used to, you know, be able to put up an antenna and catch the television signals coming from your local television station. So they put together this device that had it actually had a television screen and speakers with various kinds of antennas. They claim to have been able to tune in the past. And supposedly they were able to, like you said, Nick, they were able to watch historic events like the crucifixion of Jesus. There was even I think it was either an Italian or English magazine that ran a picture that supposedly had been taken from this view screen of Jesus' face as he died on the cross. It was later determined that this was actually a picture of a crucifix with a very life-size, life-like statue of Jesus on it. However, the priest had said that at one point that this picture was not one that was taken through the coronavirus. And that the newspaper had actually just ran that picture to illustrate the story, but leaving out the part that, you know, it wasn't the actual picture. But after a while, the story goes, the Vatican decided that this was maybe a little, you know, too hot of an item and ordered it dismantled, and then the parts were stored away somewhere in the Vatican archive. And, you know, people may wonder why, and it makes perfect sense to me, Nick, because if you think about it, if you had the ability to tune in to the past, any time, any place, any person, there would be no secrets left. Nobody could keep any kind of secret. And, wow. You know, that sounds superficial, but if you think about it, just think about it. Anything that we do or say in our lifetime, we all have things that we don't want other people to see. But if you had a device that could tune in to anything like that, our society, we're not mature enough to be able to handle something like that.
Absolutely
so,
true. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see why the Vatican would decide, you know, well, I mean, yeah, and think about all the politicians, you know, too, all across the planet. Who are like, there's no way you're going to have a device like that to, you know, to find out what I've been doing.
You know, I'm thinking just as you were saying this, that's one hell of a movie idea. Can you imagine a movie based on what you just said? Oh, wow.
Oh
my God.
Oh, yeah.
There'd be lines around the block.
Mm.
You know,
no, I mean,
Just talking about various people, and even if it was total fiction, wouldn't that be an amazing script?
It would be. It really would be. But, I mean, you know, just think about the everyday people, you know, who go about their lives and the secrets that they hold. Or you know, just your every mundane life. I mean, who wants to think that somebody could tune in to you taking a shower, going to the bathroom, sitting around picking your nose, things like that.
And, you know, that kind of movie could be either a amazing comedy for sure, or it could also be an amazing drama. I mean, that can go both ways, right? Don't you think?
Yeah. Oh yes, definitely.
Anyhow, it's an idea, but as we were talking just now, it just occurred to me that is one heck of a plot. Unbelievable. Also, just to bring up briefly, and you may know something about this because it's a fascinating story. I've seen it done a few times, and that is a plane that took off, and I'm not sure what year, but it was many, many years ago, and disappeared from the radar screens. Like, where is it? It was filled with people, passengers going, and it disappeared, and it never landed. And many, many years later, it did land. And did you ever hear about that particular story? It just interests me.
I have heard this story, and this has been around since probably at least the 1950s. And
okay.
I'm not quite convinced on the legitimacy of this story, Nick. I'll be honest with you, because I've looked at this before, and I have tried to track down the sources, and so far, it's just like a round robin loop of one writer copying another writer who had copied somebody who wrote it in like a paperback book at one time, and then around and around and around, newspaper sources that were cited didn't turn out anything. The newspapers didn't exist. Or the supposed date when the plane returned, there was no articles written about it. So, you know, it's a great story, but so far I have not been able to track down any legitimate sources for it.
Okay, fair enough on that. But, I was just wondering if there were any supposed photographs of who was in the plane when it landed, or what kind of condition those people were in. And again, this could be just simply made up, or it could be the real thing that was hushed up for obvious reasons. But it was just one of those things that I just wanted a chance to run that by you, because it has a real interest for me in that story. Another one, I see the time is going, but we could talk a lot of time here. But another one I really was interested in asking your opinion on is the Admiral Byrd secret journey beyond to the poles. That story, and what happened to him for sure, and then what happened when he got back, and what was silenced or not. It just was very interesting and on my mind. Could you just shed any light you might have on that subject?
Yeah, this was a story that for a long time, stories have circulated that Admiral Byrd, during one of his flights across the Arctic, that he had, and there were several variations of this, that they had come across areas that weren't frozen, that appeared to possibly be of volcanic origins, that had lush vegetation, and possibly even, if not prehistoric animals, creatures such as mammoths and mastodons, you know, things like that, to his airplane actually being abducted by disc-shaped craft that escorted them into the hollow earth through the northern polar opening, where they met with the leaders of an underground race, who basically told Byrd kind of like the same stories that we heard coming from the 1950s contactees, that, we're messing around with atomic weapons, and if we don't stop, they're going to come to the surface and kick our asses, and then sent Byrd back to relay the message. Now, one of the chief sources of this story was a Samizdat writing, which is a piece that was copied and recopied through various copying machines and then passed around over the years, that was referred to, I think it was like the secret diary of Admiral Byrd. There's several different variations of it. And
yeah,
Tim Beckley published a version of this. I think he was one of the first that actually published it. When I was doing the research for my book on it, I discovered actually that rather than flying over the Arctic at the time that it was sighted, which would have been early 1947. All right. He was actually, okay. Admiral Byrd was actually involved with an operation that was going on the complete opposite side of the planet in Antarctica, and this was called Operation High Jump.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Operation High Jump was a very mysterious thing all of its own, because you had all of these naval ships that, because of the end of the war, World War II, they were being decommissioned. But suddenly, the Navy was like, "No, let's go and get all these ships out of mothball. Let's get all these soldiers together, a submarine, a small aircraft carrier, and have this expedition to Antarctica." For what reasons? Well, let's see. Maybe we're going to be looking for mineral rights or maybe training soldiers in case the Soviets tried to come over the Arctic by, say, the Bering Straits and invade America. We're just not really too sure. But Operation High Jump had thousands of troops and equipment going down to Antarctica. They were supposed to be down there for a couple of months, but actually only ended up staying about 6 weeks because they said that the Arctic summer, which was just starting at the time, was becoming too stormy, and they came back. But one of the South American newspaper reporters that was on this expedition with them wrote a story after interviewing Byrd that Byrd said that he actually was on his way back to the United States so he could have a debriefing with Congress and tell them that he was afraid that the United States and the Western Hemisphere was going to be invaded by, as he called it, missiles coming over the polar regions. And
wow.
But that's after he came back and gave his debriefing, nothing was ever written about it. And so
exactly.
There's been all kinds
and
of...
I'm so intrigued about that. I'm intrigued that's exactly... It was hushed up. It was like, don't say a word. It's gone. You didn't have that experience. And that really, it intrigues me, of course, I'm sure with other people too. What was the real truth here?
Well, and that's just it. You know, there's been all kinds of speculation. And you realize that, Operation High Jump was not conducted in secrecy at the beginning. There's actually a documentary that was made during the whole operation. They had military cameramen and reporters on board that made this film, and you can find it on YouTube, but it's just really cagey about why they're actually there. So, the main speculation is that possibly they were looking for a secret Nazi base that had been established Antarctica. Some of the submarine captains that gave themselves up in South America after the end of the war claimed that they had actually dropped off equipment, scientists, and other personnel at this base in Antarctica after leaving, South Africa, I think, to reach it, and then went to South America and gave themselves up. And Great Britain apparently also had some, some very good intel that there was something going on down there. So there's the speculation that that was one of the reasons that that Byrd and everybody else were down there looking for this secret Nazi base. It would have been about 10 years later, the United States signed a treaty with about 12 other nations that Antarctica was like a free zone, that nobody really had any claim to it, and that there would be no atomic testing in Antarctica either. So it's just it's funny how all that came about at around the same time, and we're still left with a lot of questions on just exactly what they were looking for, and if what they were looking for, did they find it?
Exactly right. It's just one of those stories that won't go away, and it's still out there, but it's quite something with a lot of ramifications, as you can imagine. So I just wanted to run that past you. One other one, if I may, we have only a little bit of time left, but I don't believe you did a book on this, but I just like your thoughts on one of von Braun, which you've already mentioned, and at the end of his life, he talked about the master plan, and he said the big another master plan at the end of that was going to be a false attack that would be attributed to ETs actually attacking our world, and that the whole purpose of that would be to put all the governments of the world on their knees begging for one government that would protect us. And of course, the New World Order would step in and say, we will do that. I don't know if Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum would be the head of it. It would not be anything voted. It would simply be, we need this, and that therefore we will have our attention and only look to a one world government for the entire world's affairs. And von Braun said, this is a plan that is going to take place for sure. And the thing that prompts me on this is we have now satellites that can do all kinds of imagery. It can project objects that you would swear were there that aren't. There's incredible satellites that now can take sounds and voices and project them into any parts of the world, and so much more. And there's a lot more to that story, too. So it seems to me as though we've never been more geared up technically for something like this. And von Braun was very serious about the fact that this is part of the master plan. This is one of the last pieces of the plan to have one world order. And that's the way they're going to do it, by totally terrorizing everybody on this planet to falling in line, lockstep. And I would just love any comments you might have on that particular issue.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, and I don't know if you know this, but there was actually an episode of the old science fiction television show called The Outer Limits that was its plot. It was a small group of scientists who decided that they were going to fool the world with a possible alien invasion. And actually, one of their own drew the short straw, and he found and they surgically manipulated him to look like this horrible alien, and then shot him into low Earth orbit so he could, you know, land on Earth. And I guess announced that, you know, he was the representative from an alien race, and that if we don't that we, you know, we can't stop him, and to try to cause all the nations to join together to fight off this oncoming alien invasion. So, I mean, that's a story that's been circulating for quite a while. And like you said, Nick, I mean, I certainly do think that we probably have the technology to create a hoax like that. I just don't know if anybody is really brave enough to attempt that. I mean, trying to get every country in the planet to fall into lockstep, like you said, even in the event of a possible alien invasion, it would be like herding cats. You know, I mean, people are just too crazy. we have minds of our own, and this whole suggestion that somebody could pull that off and fool everybody, they may try it, but I don't think it would be successful. And it wouldn't surprise me if somebody hasn't, you know, thought of that. I mean, just like, say, somebody thought of it as a plot for a 1960s television show, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, like, some elites hadn't been trying that.
Absolutely right. And technically, the major countries, including, of course, the United States in recent publications, has admitted that craft, starships have been captured, either the remains of a crashed one or whole ones. And they've admitted that aliens from other places have been working with the government. I mean, there's stories like that. So if these countries had the actual craft, they could certainly reproduce them. It would take a lot of work, but they could do that. And then they would then be part of this alien invasion, and you would, and there they are. I mean, they could land on in Central Park, for God's sake, and it would be a real craft, and it would be obviously crafted from another planet. I mean, that could, they could do that worldwide to the major centers of the world. And I think it's really possible. I would hate to think it would actually take place, but I would not put anything, repeat, anything past what could possibly be happening in the near future. And I mean near future.
I hate to interrupt, but just to let you know, we have 4 minutes left.
Oh, my God. You know, Tim, you know this. It goes so fast.
It does.
If you have out there, the listeners, if you have any questions or comments, love to hear them. I'm going to give you my email one more time, NICKNYNY1, that's the number one, at gmail.com. And if you have a question for me or a comment or for Tim, please let me know that, and I will forward it on to Tim. Tim, my heartfelt thanks to you, sir, for an amazing show. I knew it was going to be, and certainly it is. And I just want to thank you so much. And I'm going to ask you in the new year, at some point in the new year, when you have another hour to spare, I would love to have you back for a part two.
Well, Nick, as always, I have a great time talking with you. And whenever you want me to come back on, I would be more than happy to continue this conversation, because this is the type of stuff that I could talk about for hours.
Me too, my friend. Me too. Thank you so much. Much love to you. This is Nick Curto for Disclosure Network New York, wishing you all an enlightened journey as you connect the dots to seek truth. Till next time, keep informed, stay safe, and be very, very kind to one another. Much love to everyone out there, not only on this planet, but well beyond. Until we meet again, understand that the immense intergalactic family is out there, and the Master Universe is there, and we need to send love to them, and seems like contact is imminent. Okay, goodbye for now. Much love to everyone out there.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you, Tim, for an awesome show. I wish we had more time. And thanks to a wonderful audience for tuning in. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called in you're in our queue patiently listening, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Nick and Tim.
You're more than welcome. Take care, everybody.